WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
About half the states in the country produce comprehensive state atlases. As a visitor to Philadelphia, my eye was caught by one of the newest, the State Atlas of Pennsylvania. It's a large format, coffee table-sized book, more than 300 pages filled with maps and graphs. Besides the traditional maps you'd expect to find in an atlas that shows us places, there's a section on human patterns that shows us who we are. My guest, geographer Wilbur Zielinski, edited this section. I wanted to know how these other aspects of our culture came to be included in an atlas.
Well, a geographical atlas, Sedge, is a kind of geographic encyclopedia, a combination of maps, photographs, text, graphs, line drawings, whatever will tell the story. Geographers can and should be interested in the totality of a human experience and the physical world as well.
There's a concept that you use in your atlas that I think, although you report on Pennsylvania, could be used for any state in the union, particularly those where there are baseball fans, and it's the concept of a fan shed instead of a watershed. Could you explain how this idea, this...
That's not original with us. The fan shed, as best we can define it, is the area within which you have fans for a particular team in a particular sport, and they demonstrate their allegiance to the team by coming to games, obviously, and listening to radio broadcasts thereof or watching TV broadcasts when those are available. And we mapped the fan sheds for the major professional basketball, baseball, and football teams by plotting the location of radio stations that normally carry the broadcasts.
Well, looking at the map, for instance, I can see that there are certain areas where Pirates fans overlap with the Phillies fans, and Yankees overlap with the Mets and the Cleveland Indians.
And the Baltimore Orioles and on,
So you're actually dealing with kind of emotional topography.
Yes.
Rather than actual physical topography.
Yeah. It'd be nice if we could map other aspects of emotional geography. It's a tough proposition. But people in this country get more excited about sport than almost anything else. It's an important thing to map. So we have generous coverage of professional, college, and a few amateur sports.
One of your own studies has been the geography of marriage and marriage days. And I wonder if you could talk a bit what that means.
I've been intrigued with the question of when people, what day of the week and what month of the year people choose for the marriage ceremony. Now, this seems like a trivial question. It's not. In the 19th century, people married in the late fall. October, November, and December were the favored months. June was not important. Then there was a switch starting in one part of the country, the Northeast, and gradually engulfing the whole country. Summer weddings became popular. And there was also a switch from, would you believe it, a maximum on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays to the weekend, and of course, Saturday. Now, why is this worth looking at? Because it indicates basic social change, basic changes in the way people think. Nobody tells you when to get married. It's a personal or family decision. But when millions of people decide to follow a different pattern, it tells you there's been a social revolution, that the nature of American life has changed.
And what was the change that you saw?
Well, from an agrarian society where people, where the most important part of the year was the harvest season, the only season where you had abundance and leisure, to the present period in which we become a society of consumers and where leisure is highly valued and where we have a 4 or 5 day week where we all think about the weekend and about the summer vacation. That is a tremendous psychological revolution, you might say.
Geographers do research in a number of sometimes imaginative ways. For instance, when you wanted to find out once about how far north the word Dixie was used, you looked through the yellow pages of different communities?
Yeah. I might say that the Classified Directory is one of my favorite books. The idea was very simple, and it was borrowed from a good friend of mine who's a sociologist who first studied the location of Dixie. You look at a telephone directory and see whether the term, in this case, Dixie or Southern or some variant of that term occurs, and if so, how many times, and compare it with other terms of regional or cultural significance. Doing that, I think I have a pretty good handle on the vernacular regions of North America, the regions as perceived by the people themselves, not by us professional geographers.
So by looking in the phone book and seeing that Dixie Auto Supply or something can be found at a certain point north, you could actually then make a map out of where Dixie is perceived by its residents to be.
Or where the term Dixie is relatively important. Of course, you'll find some of these terms have become universal, but the way they bunch up on the map is, I think, a sensitive indication of the way people perceive their regions.
I want to talk a little bit more about the atlas here. Much of the information in there, it relies on census information. And we have a new census coming up in just a couple of months, yet the atlas is just out, and a lot of the information is from the early 80s. Is this a frustration?
It's a tremendous frustration. In fact, any atlas is obsolete by the time it goes to the printer. And you can't do much about that. Some of the data here, by the way, is much older than 1980. For some items, we had to go back much further, and not just in the historical section. Yeah, it's a major frustration, Sedge, but it's universal. In geography, you're always dealing with a changing world, and between the time you gather your data, analyze it, map it, send it to the printer, get it to the stores or your colleagues, the world has already changed. It's not like a daily newspaper where you're with it just minutes or hours behind the event. We are months or years, sometimes decades behind the reality.
How did you develop your interest in geography and where places are and how people use them?
Well, I guess, like most professional geographers, I was born with the geographic bug, although it took me a long time to discover that fact. About midway through my college career, I discovered I had to make a living, and the only skill I had that was worth developing was a certain aptitude for drawing maps. So I took some training in cartography, and I actually got gainful employment in doing this. But the more I worked with maps, the more I realized that what I was really interested in was the much larger related field of geography. And I'm still fascinated by maps. For me, it's the most effective way to understand the world. That's really the geographic project, not just to map things, but using maps as an entree into the nature of reality.
J.B. Jackson, another geographer, once commented on the decline of the crab cake and how it was passing, because it represented the end of crab fisheries, a certain sort of handwork that went into putting the crab cake together. But now with a resurgence of regional cooking and regional cuisine, the crab cake is making its way back onto onto menus. And this seems to be sort of a geographical trend.
It is, and I'm not going to tip my hand, but it's something I will be looking at in the near future, the rise of regional cuisines.
Let me ask how an atlas gets put together in this way.
With great difficulty.
if you came to the editorial committee and said, I'd like to put in a map on the spread of the crab cake and where it's found, would that be taken seriously? Would that be laughed at?
No, because we five editors pretty much made our own decisions for the sections and pages for which we had responsibility. So, for example, I put in a map of Little League baseball entirely on my own, which might seem facetious to some people. It's not, because I used my own judgment, stuck my neck out and said, this is something we have to have. Nobody else has done. Let's put it in.
What was interesting for you about Little Leagues?
Well, this was one of the great surprises. The data were easy to get because the national or international headquarters is in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. They gave us a list with no difficulty. We mapped them, and we discovered a very uneven concentration. Lots around Philadelphia, for example, lots of them up in the Anthracite. not a single one in Dauphin County, that is Harrisburg, or Lancaster County, or several other counties which are urban where you expect them. I don't know the answer. But you see, the map is it's like a detective story. Here is the map. There are the clues. Try to solve the mystery.
What is the pleasure that you get from looking at a map? Is it sensual? Is it intellectual? Both?
A map is a work of art. It's also a scientific thing. There's no reason why designed objects, a piece of machinery, an automobile, a useful thing, cannot also be beautiful. We had a very good designer, so we have in these drawings, maps and graphs and whatever, things which are, I think are both useful and a joy to the eye.
Wilbur Zielinski, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
It's been great fun. Thank you, Sedge.
Wilbur Zielinski is a professor emeritus of geography at Pennsylvania State University and a co-editor of the new Atlas of Pennsylvania, published by Temple University Press.